coming up on Philosophy Talk.
My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
An eye for an eye, the morality of revenge.
You've got an overdeveloped sense of vengeance. It's going to get you into trouble someday.
Americans react in horror to societies that cut off a thief's hands.
But we might take 10 years out of that thief's life without thinking twice.
A crooked cop who got mixed up in the rackets and got what was coming. That's a terrific story.
Does an eye for an eye really make the whole world blind?
Our guest is Thane Rosenbaum, author of Payback, The Case for Revenge.
The best revenge is living well. There's no chance of that.
An eye for an eye.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that started at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford. That's where Ken and I hang out.
Today, it's an eye for an eye, the morality of revenge.
Well, whether it's some jerk who cuts you off in traffic, or some idiot who commits a violent crime against a person you love, the desire for getting even, for payback, is a very natural human response.
Natural, John, but the big question, the philosophical question, is whether it's a response we should ever act on. Is revenge, taking revenge, ever the moral thing to do?
Well, of course it is. If you cause someone to suffer, you should suffer too. It's only just, it's only fair that you pay back for what you've done. Revenge is a way of restoring balance in the moral universe.
Oh, you've been watching too many Dirty Harry movies or something, John. Revenge just makes things worse. It ups the ante. It escalates violence. How does that restore anything?
Because getting even restores a victim's sense of worth and honor and empowerment. Imagine someone commits a heinous crime against someone you love. Wouldn't you want that person to suffer, to pay for what they did?
Of course I would. I would want to wring their necks with my own hands if I could. But we're not talking about personal reactions. We're talking about justice, criminal justice. In the case of meting out punishment, just punishment, cooler heads need to prevail, not emotion.
Well, justice is all about getting even. I mean, after all, isn't that why we punish wrongdoers in the first place?
That's such a benighted view, John. Justice isn't about payback. It's about deterrence. It's about reformation, rehabilitation, forgiveness. That's what justice is about.
Oh, God. I've got a bridge in Brooklyn I'd like to sell you, Ken, if that's what you think that it's all about. Locking up people, you think it deters crime, reforms criminals, maybe occasionally. But basically, you're living in a fantasy world. Punishment is about revenge, pure and simple. An eye for an eye.
I like what Gandhi said about that. An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind.
Well, good for Gandhi. I don't think he even understood the point of an eye for an eye. After all, in the context, it wasn't really calling for revenge. That was taken for granted. It was calling for limiting revenge so that it's proportionate to the crime. You can take an eye for an eye, but no more.
So, look, it follows. You think that every murderer should be put to death. But I would have thought, I know you, I would have thought you were against the death penalty.
Well, I'm not against a death penalty when people commit crimes that are so heinous that they ought to be put to death.
But the criminal justice system is an utter mess. I mean, think of the people on death row. A lot of poor people, a lot of people of color, people who don't have the kind of access to resources that rich people do. You call that justice?
No. And I don't call the current system a system of justice in any literal sense. It's a system of injustice. But that doesn't change the fact that there are people who deserve to die. Didn't Timothy McVeigh deserve to die? The justice system needs to do a better job figuring out who those people are. Grant you that.
But look, even if we were 100% certain of who the real murderers are, I just think there's a higher path. Francis Bacon put it nicely. He said, in taking revenge, a man is but even with his enemy. But in passing it over, he is superior.
Come on, Ken. Turn the other cheek. That's very New Testament of you.
Well, look, I grant it is New Testament. And look what they did in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Forgiveness can be a powerful thing, John. We should move more toward restorative justice and away from revenge. That's my view.
Restorative justice? That only works when the perpetrators of a crime are genuinely willing to accept responsibility and the victims have to buy into it, too.
So you accept that forgiveness, when possible, is a higher path. I'm pleased.
No, I didn't say that. I don't really believe that. Justice means we reward good deeds and we punish bad ones. Everyone gets their just desserts. We've lost track of that basic truth in our criminal justice system.
Well, you know, I disagree. I think an eye for an eye is just not the way to go. And I wonder if revenge is actually any good for crime victims themselves, to tell you the truth.
Well, Ken, to answer that question, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, out to investigate the psychological side of revenge. She files this report.
16 years ago, Michael Overstreet kidnapped, raped, and murdered a college student. He was sentenced to death by a jury in Indiana. The victim's brother and mother told the local TV station it was the only punishment they'd accept.
If you commit a crime as heinous as he did, I don't think there is any other punishment that should be done.
You know, I don't really want to sit and watch somebody die, but for what he did, he deserves to die.
It turns out there's a reason why it feels so good to know someone who's caused harm will suffer in turn.
What you see happen at the neural level is activation of the brain's reward anticipation centers.
Michael McCullough teaches psychology at the University of Miami. He's author of the book Beyond Revenge, The Evolution of the Forgiveness Instinct.
So someone who's seeking revenge or who craves revenge really has the brain activation patterns of someone who perceives a reward, in the form of food or drink. It looks like a goal that we are actively perceiving out of a sense of craving.
From an evolutionary perspective, McCullough says revenge makes sense.
In lots of places in nature, you get evolution for what I call anti-exploitation devices, features of organisms that seem well-designed for getting others to treat that organism better than they otherwise would.
For example, a frog might evolve toxins to prevent a snake from eating it. Revenge is akin to poisonous toxins in that it deters exploitative behavior, and it's nearly universal in human societies throughout history.
The reason that humans have this very profound taste for revenge, the reason why we are motivated to seek revenge, is because by doing so evolutionarily, our ancestors were able to deter other individuals from harming them.
But revenge isn't the end of the story. Humans also have the incredible ability to forgive. We are social animals, after all, and our survival depends on those around us. We've developed legal systems, courts, and prisons to curb our desire for revenge.
Capital punishment probably appeals to that strong desire we have to see wrongs righted, because that strong desire is what natural selection built into us.
Well, that may be authorized by the Constitution, but is it morally sound? After all, our Constitution at one time permitted slavery.
Bruce Fine is a constitutional lawyer in Washington, D.C. These days, he's best known for representing Edward Snowden's father, but he also makes a pretty good case for the death penalty in extreme cases like genocide.
That's an educational message, if you will. It's not retribution. Well, we just want to jump on his gravesite and vivisect him and subject him to the rack and screw.
Fine says we have to get past our individual desire for revenge and look at the death penalty as a moral statement.
I'm suggesting that there's certain behavior that is a matter of instructing the public as to what is human and what is subhuman. It's not retribution like I'm getting back at X. It's an educational mission about instructing the public, you know, this reduces you to a savage and you are killed in that when you've walked outside, you know, the pale of the human species.
When revenge is taken from the hands of individuals and transferred to the state, we call that justice, right? University of Miami's Michael McCullough says there's something tragic about being an evolved creature in a culturally complex world.
We don't expect people to go around and kill the killers of their loved ones. We insist, as a matter of fact, that they turn that grievance over to institutions and to legal authorities. But I call it a tragedy because we're still left as victims with grief and anger and often a desire for revenge that doesn't get completely satiated.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin, for that interesting roving philosophical report on deterrence, evolution, justice, and vengeance. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're asking about the morality of revenge. We're joined now by Thane Rosenbaum. He's a professor of law at Fordham University. He's author of Payback, The Case for Revenge. Thane, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you, John and Ken.
Thane, I want to start off by asking you what got you especially interested in revenge. You write passionately about it. I suspect you write passionately about everything you write about. But is there something special about revenge? Is there some personal story of vengeance that got you into this subject?
Not really, although people have wondered. I must have an investment in the subject. Obviously, I'm trying to pay back somebody. I'm very victim-centered, and Payback, The Case for Revenge, is very much a victim-centered paradigm of the justice system. It's to think about what victims need in order to feel that justice has been done. Look, my parents were Holocaust survivors, so I'm obviously sensitive to the experience of victims, and I'm a human rights law professor. In addition to being a novelist. So I obviously the world of emotional and moral complexity matters to me, which is why I'm grateful to be on this show. But I've never really actually been victimized, but I'm very sympathetic to the experience of people who have.
Well, I'm hoping your experience today won't change your view that you've never been victimized.
Well, you're so far away from me. What can I do?
Yeah, what can you do? What can you do? I think a person would be crazy to deny that the cry for revenge is a very natural human instinct. And even more so when it's not yourself, but someone you love that has been hurt. But Ken and I, in our little introductory thing, disagreed about whether it should be part of the criminal justice system. And it's pretty clear what you think. You think it should be. So tell us why. Give us kind of a brief overview of your view before we go to break.
Well, I mean, we've all essentially signed the social contract. We did it in invisible ink before we were born, but in a post-Enlightenment era, we all assume that we're signatories to the social contract, which meant that the natural history of our species, in which we were entitled under the rule of man to take vengeance on our behalf or on behalf of our families in order to even the score or redeem the debt or reclaim honor, is now transferred over to the state. And the state, in return for tax dollars, will play a surrogate or proxy role. And the victims will come to these courthouses built as shrines where disputes can get resolved. And so if the social contract insists on the rule of law over the rule of man, then I think that the state has an obligation to do what victims need to actually feel vindicated and to feel avenged in the aftermath.
But once we assign this over to the state, it's not just about me and the victim and the perpetrator. It's also the state has its own interest, its independent interest in seeing that wrongs don't go unpunished, and it has a different set of desiderata. I mean, crimes now are crimes against the state, and they're punished not primarily for the victim's case, but for the state's interest. Doesn't that change things at least a little, briefly?
But it's wrong. I mean, it's simply fundamentally morally wrong. You're quite right when you say it's state versus Jones, people versus Jones, mm-hmm. Wisconsin versus Jones. Jones is a bad guy, by the way. We never say victim versus Jones. We essentially say in all instances the punishment is done for the benefit of society, and in no instance are we doing it for the vindication of the victim. We do the exact opposite. But if there's a debt that's owed to society, there's at least a debt that's also owed equally to the victim, and we ignore that debt. And instead, we allow the debt to be discounted in order to more efficiently administer the system. And in doing so, we deny and devalue and trivialize the experience of the victim.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're asking about the morality of revenge with our guest, Thane Rosenbaum from Fordham University, author of Payback, The Case for Revenge.
After the break, we're going to dig deeper into the relationship between justice and revenge. Are they opposed to one another? Are they the same thing? Do they somehow mesh?
Crime, revenge, and justice. Plus, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Payback, revenge. But is that justice? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're asking about an eye for an eye, the morality of revenge.
Our guest is Thane Rosenbaum from Fordham University Law School. He's the author of Payback, The Case for Revenge.
So, Thane, in your book, so we want to talk about, what's the relationship between vengeance and justice? People often think those are contrasting things. You make the claim, maybe a radical claim, that a call for justice is always, always a cry for revenge. I have to say, I'm a little skeptical about that. Give me your best case that a call for justice just is a call for revenge.
Well, there can be no justice that we can declare in true ways justice unless victims feel avenged. Otherwise, people leave courthouses, throw their arms up into the air and say there's no justice in the world. Victims go home and kick the cat because they felt that they were betrayed by a legal system that wasn't able to vindicate the crime committed against them and right the wrong. And similarly, revenge is never moral if it's disproportionate. You know, I forgot which one of you, I can't remember which one, John or Ken, is on my side.
I'm the handsome one.
Yeah, I could tell. But when one of you said, you know, revenge is terrible because it escalates violence, that's just simply not true. That's a myth. In the natural history of our species, and this is why Gandhi's wrong when he said that the world would be entirely, all the world would be blind. If that's true, we'd all be blind. For the natural history of our species, we worked off of the eye for an eye model, and we knew that it was supposed to be a precise amount of measurement that measured what payback was required and due. Everyone acted like CPAs and accountants. Exactitude mattered because if you exceeded the eye, if you got more than an eye, then you would invite a recycling of revenge. But everyone sought to get even so that they could end the conflict. We go out of our way to make these distinctions. We twist ourselves in knots between justice and revenge, in part because we say justice is cool, it's dispassionate, it's mechanical and rational, and vengeance is all hot-blooded and emotional. But really, people come to courthouses at their most vulnerable. Of course they're emotional beings, and of course they have emotional and moral needs. And we have to accommodate those needs because, again, they forfeited a right that they would have had throughout the natural history of our species only in a post-Enlightenment era. And they're entitled to know that the people who have created moral injury have been paid back and received their just deserts.
Now, Thane, in the I mean, you're in a law school, so I better be careful here. But my understanding is, in tort law and civil law, it's quite different. There, the victim, the aggrieved party, sues and has his or her lawyer in court, and then the aggrieving or allegedly aggrieving party has their lawyer, and it's between the two of them with the judge. Then in the criminal law, it's much different. The aggrieved party, the victim, has really no representation in the American system. It's just the state, the district attorney, versus the defense attorney. So you'd like to see it in the criminal law more like it is in the civil law. Is that a misconstrual of what you're saying?
No, I think it's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, the way we implement it now, the victim is the one party in a criminal action who has no representation. The one party that can be told by a judge to sit in the back of the courtroom because we don't want the jury to see you crying. It might unduly influence the jury.
But now that,
you know, instead,
That's because the American system is supposed to bend over backwards to make sure nobody's unjustly convicted, right? So it's not, I mean, I don't know why a judge would say that, but he might be saying that because, well, you believe this guy did it, but it hasn't been proven, and your tears are going to be disruptive to the juror.
I want to take you guys back. I want to take you guys back, though. I think those are really good questions, but I want to take you back to something more foundational. I mean, I think there's a reason. You were getting at a reason, a practical reason. But look, you said, Thane, and you said rightly, when we enter the social contract, we give up the right to be the judge, jury, and executioner in our own case. We give it over to the state. Now, because the problem is, you said people are attuned to this proportionality. I'll tell you something. You cut me off in traffic. It's not that I want to cut you off in traffic, too. I want to shoot you or something. I give you the finger, but if I could wring your neck, I would. Now, you might think, what a violent guy you are. But that would be my impulse. I don't want to be governed by my impulse. I don't think people's impulses for revenge are just proportional. I mean, I don't want to just take your eye if you take my eye. I'm going to take your freaking head off.
Well, Ken, right? Ken, you're talking about your immediate, completely visceral reaction.
Well, right.
I'm sure if you sat down with coffee with a guy that pulled you over in traffic, you would just give him a tongue lashing.
No, because I don't want him to do it again. I don't just want to pay back.
I know.
I want to make sure that he knows I am not to be messed with.
Oh, okay.
So tell me why. Well, tell me about this proportionality thing that you're talking about. How people are so attuned to the proportionality. I don't believe you. I don't think that's true.
Well, natural history proved me right. I mean, we wouldn't be here. You would know more families like the Hatfields and the McCoys. You only know one because that was the one that went out of control. You would be able to name me hundreds and hundreds of families. You'd say, Thane, I've got a list. These feuds never ended.
They were in Canada, right?
John accused me of being so New Testament, but I've read the Old Testament too. There's that thing where they raped Jacob. Was it Jacob? Abraham's daughter or Jacob's daughter?
No, it is Jacob's daughter.
Jacob's daughter, right? And the sons went back and tricked the whole village and killed all the males.
Yeah.
That's right up there in the Bible.
And you know what the lesson is with that? The lesson is you can't do that. Jacob doesn't object to the fact that his sons punished the rapist. He was upset about the escalation of it, the recycling of it, the disproportion of it. That's the biblical lesson. The biblical lesson is payback was due. Everybody understood that. The daughter was raped. But you've gone now too far, and you were not entitled to kill everyone in the village and take all of their possessions. So that's the message that one were supposed to take away from that story.
But you know, combining the Bible here with evolution, which in it sometimes useful. So,
despite the fundamentalists,
yeah. In your book, you trace, the roots of our concept of justice. But also our concept of revenge, the whole practice of revenge, has a certain evolutionary sense or a certain rationale, but that rationale is in terms of deterrence. That is, small tribes, cities, families don't want to be messed with. And the way they get across that they don't want to be messed with is make it clear that you mess with us and we will mess with you. The deterrence part was fine as far as killing a whole village for the rape of a daughter, and then the eye for an eye says no, you got to have this other thing. So it suggests that our concept of justice really has several roots, including deterrence. But you're pretty hard on deterrence in your book. Couldn't somebody say, well, the appeal to deterrence as a really important consideration in punishment is actually fits in with this whole account of how revenge got its legitimacy?
Well, it was only one of the factors. There was also this idea that we're afraid to talk about, which is the word desert. This is what's deserved. Yes, there is a deterrence factor, but there's also a just deserts factor. This is what is owed, and this is what's required to be repaid. A lot of it has to do with honor in the aftermath of moral injury. The reclaiming of honor mattered to people, to tribes, not just the deterrence factor, but that honor needed to be restored. That one of you said moral balance returned to the moral universe. In the book, I'm tough on deterrence because we see it from the criminal justice system when it comes to criminal violence and wrongdoing, that it really doesn't deter crimes. And yet there is what Steven Pinker describes as a deterrence paradox, that even when we know deterrence doesn't work, why do we still punish? We must punish because ultimately we're all retributivists at heart. We all believe in just desserts.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about an eye for an eye, the morality of revenge. We'd love to have you join this conversation. And Ariana from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ariana.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a few points. The first thing I would like to say is I think we need to understand that the government is not a monolithic institution. And saying that, I need to say this, that we assume a lot when we think that it's a neutral arbitrator of justice, when we can decide whom we kill, and we assume that we're a Judeo-Christian country, and yet in the Old Testament, one of the commandments was, thou shalt not murder. Our government kills individuals all around the world in the name of honor or morality or democracy, which really is, I feel, a cover for self-interest or...
That's an interesting point, but it's a little off our topic. I mean, we're talking about revenge and justice. Now, what's your question about that?
Okay, so I would ask how we could be more functioning from our new brain, our cerebellum, our sense of spirituality and restraint, instead of the old brain of revenge. And I don't think that the U.S. is in any case... a neutral or arbitrator, and I'm very, very concerned about our position, both in relationship to the world
thanks.
And then internally.
Ariana, thanks for the question. So, Thane, the new brain versus the old machine. Ariana seems to think that revenge is part of the atavistic animal nature, and we need to overcome that. What do you think about that?
I mean, I'm sure she's lovely, but it's silly. It's utterly silly. There's no such thing as a new brain and an old brain. We have one brain. And as your professor from University of Miami, Michael McCullough, pointed out, there's science to back this up, studies that were in Austria and in Switzerland and in Princeton, New Jersey. We are wired for fairness, justice, hardwired for fairness, justice, and retaliation. We find it unbearable to watch somebody take advantage of someone else, even if it's not us directly. They connect people to MRI machines and PET scan machines, and they see that even the bystanders find it intolerable. I love the way you produced the show with all of those famous movie lines that invoke revenge themes. And then you even had, I don't know if that was a James Brown soul record.
Yes, it was.
Revenge.
It was.
Let me tell you something. You know, for all this talk about we condemn revenge as a primitive past, it's amazing how much we are addicted to it as part of our culture. And you know why we are? Because it's fundamentally right. That righting a wrong is something that we all feel that is essential. Allowing people to get away with crimes is morally intolerable. It's very simple. We don't treat revenge like porn. We treat it as something that we understand. People don't walk out of revenge movies and say, this is disgusting. They're completely fascinated, and they won't move until the wrongdoer is paid back.
Some people do. I mean, I want to put in my two cents for Ariana here. I mean, I think in a way she's making a point that you make, although from 180 degrees away. That is, what the U.S. does around the world in the name of justice is often, as you point out, it's really just revenge. I mean, why did we kill Osama bin Laden? And the outcry that we should have brought him in was very minor and very muted. And you make the point, it's revenge. And I think she thinks it's revenge. She thinks it's
bad.
I think it's fine.
I make the point that it's both justice and revenge.
Yeah, right.
I take the same point that I've made throughout the book.
Same thing. It's got to be both.
Well, but look, guys, I want to interject something here. I mean, because you guys are kind of agreeing, and I want to... I think you're right, Thane, that revenge is an element of our views about just punishment and all. But I don't think it exhausted, and I don't really think it's about the individual as much. But there's the Game of Thrones, the Red Wedding, in which the Starks are slaughtered. And Lady Stark has the what's-his-face's wife and says, you release my son and I'll let go of your wife. And he says to her? I'll get another wife. You know, and he kills the wife. She kills the wife. She slits her throat, and he goes on. He's going to get another wife. So look, I think it's about whenever somebody commits a crime, they impose a cost. They impose a cost on the victim, they impose a cost on the society. That's all true. And one of the things about punishment, it's got to impose a cost back on the perpetrator. That's true, but that's equal parts revenge and deterrence. I don't think it's either or. I mean, if it was enough for me that you took his eye out, but it wouldn't deter him because he didn't value his eye, society would say, well, you got to do more than take his eye out, because we had to send a message.
But there's a danger, because we have these victimless crimes. It seems to me if we go Thane's way, victimless crimes, we wouldn't have such silly punishments for crimes where there's no real victim. We wouldn't. I mean, an eye for an eye. You put somebody in 10 years in jail for smoking pot or selling pot. That's not an eye for an eye.
If we go things,
revenge would be more humane many cases than our current
victimless
system.
Crimes are, and they may not have an assignable victims, but they still impose the cost on the rest of us, and we have to impose costs back on them to not make it worth it. But Thane, why don't you react to our back and forth here?
Well, I mean, why would we punish then if we've determined, as many criminologists tell us now, that punishment doesn't deter crimes? Why don't we just say, if it doesn't deter crimes, we set everyone free? Wouldn't that be morally unbearable, unsustainable,
minute,
and untenable for us to live in such a world?
Don't you think that the potential criminal is making some kind of cost-benefit analysis? They're making some cost-benefit analysis. I'm going to rob this bank and get $1 million. But if I say, you're not going to get away, and if you get caught, blah, 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 that's got to figure in their cost-benefit analysis. You don't think?
So what's your point? That we don't punish properly, so we have insufficient deterred people?
No, because
we certainly are not using our criminal justice system as an adequate deterrence method, because criminals are still among us.
Well, that's true, but I mean, part of our point is not just getting back. That's retrospective. We impose costs prospectively, not just retrospectively. But you know what? There's a lot more to talk about here, and we're going to dig in with lineup of callers. We got one final segment, and you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the morality of revenge with Thane Rosenbaum from Fordham University.
If seeking justice is seeking revenge, where do we draw the line? How do we decide appropriate punishments? Does the death penalty have any place in civil society?
Revenge and just punishment when Philosophy Talk continues.
She's gonna get you now, one way or another. Now that's revenge. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and the program today is An Eye for an Eye, The Morality of Revenge. Our guest is Thane Rosenbaum, author of Payback, The Case for Revenge. And we've got a lineup of callers. Pat in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Pat.
Yes, for me personally, I believe that the state has no moral or ethical business of executing an individual for a crime. But with that said, if a crime is so heinous that demands a life, then it should be done by either the victim or a media family of the victim.
Oh, wow, man. That's pretty bloodthirsty.
That's an interesting combination of views.
If we're going to have executions, it should be done by the victim or the media family of the victim and not the state.
Thanks for the call, Pat. What do you think of that suggestion, Thane?
I was just thinking about if we could get the other caller together with this caller, they should go on a date or they should go bowling together. It would be lovely. I would just love to hear them speak. Look, righteous man, righteous. Look, what he's saying is that I don't accept the authority of the social contract, but I accept the moral imperative of punishment being done. And I forgot which one of you said when you said Thane, you know, when we give up the social contract, we forfeit our rights. My response to that is, well, we don't forfeit our right that it be done and be done properly.
Right.
We only forfeit the idea that we get to do it ourselves.
Right.
Look, there are places around the world right now that are still revenge and honor cultures, where there is where legal enforcement is weak, and it still needs to be done according to the old lex talionis. And you know what? Justice gets done. And by the way, you know, we see that here even in South Central Los Angeles, in your state. You know, there's that old Public Enemy song said, you know, 911 is a joke. You know what the point of that is we don't depend on a police. We don't depend on the DAs. We have to do it internally.
Of course.
And somehow justice gets done.
Of course, Nate. I know that you don't endorse reading your book, you make a distinction between vigilantism. I mean, it's important that, I mean, the state may be imperfect, but it's important that we have the state to do these things in a cold, dispassionate, just manner that can be seen to be fair and not merely driven by personal emotion and personal self, you know. I mean, you agree with that?
Yeah. I do agree with it, but then I say something at the end that will drive many people nuts, which is to say, yes, I believe that the legal system has the obligation to handle this, and it should be done in this way because it avoids the tracking down costs and the messiness of individuals like your last caller going off to have to do it himself. But I'll say this, when the legal system fails, which it so often does, and the avenger now needs to do what's just and right in order to right the wrong, we shouldn't treat that avenger, whoever, whether he be the victim or someone deputized by the victim, as this is a separate, independent, predetermined crime. We should treat it the way we treat of self-defense, that we should recognize that it's either a legal excuse because it had to be done by the individual, or some mitigating factors need to be added to this, because what we see now is morally unbearable to go unpunished and therefore the victim be unavenged.
But the problem with that, Thane, is that now you're leaving – the legal system works. It follows the procedures. The victim's family are dissatisfied. By their own lights, it wasn't just. But now you're just leaving it to every individual to judge whether the justice system, working as it's empowered to work, is doing its job. I mean, that's just back in the state of nature.
Not really. It's not so hard to judge. You know, there's a recent case that came out of Rhode Island. I talk about it in the book. Mm-hmm. I had an op-ed in connection with in the New York Times op-ed. I wrote about this, too. It was a story of a father whose 5-year-old son was kidnapped and eaten by a pedophile. And then the pedophile shellacked the boy's bones. They identified the wrongdoer. He admitted it. The bones were in his house. There was no DNA evidence that could ever be surfaced that would show a different wrongdoer. He was given a plea bargain of 40 years. And because of an earned time law in the state of Massachusetts where he was serving a sentence, he was allowed to cut the punishment from 40 to 27. So he was already a young man at this point, and he was scheduled to be released in a few months, and the papers went to speak to the father, and he said unapologetically, unabashedly, he said, if this man is released anywhere in my vicinity, I do intend to kill this man. And everyone said, this is outrageous. The man is now claiming that he'll be engaged in self-help. But everyone in the town said, yeah, you're right, and if this guy comes, we're going to shoot him, because there was something that was fundamentally wrong, morally unfair, that this guy would be given, you know, a discount. You know, in every part of our lives, gentlemen, we don't like discounts. Landlords want to be paid on time. Merchants want to be only in crime do we accept discounts. In every other aspect, we expect to be paid in full. Why can't victims say, I need to feel that I've been made even?
Well, I have a good deal of sympathy with that. I think if Timothy McVeigh had been given plea bargain down to 20 years and moved back to Oklahoma City, there wouldn't have been a lot of blame if people had taken law in their own hands.
I would blame them. I would say justice system is corrupt and needs to be changed, but that doesn't license you to become a vigilante.
I wouldn't say it would license them. I didn't say there wouldn't be any blame. I didn't say they'd be doing the right thing. I want to shift gears a little. We got an email from Larissa in Berkeley. She says, can you ask your guest to comment on practices like caning in countries like Singapore? That might be satisfying for victims, but is it justice? Before asking our guest to comment, I'm going to comment. I think the caning in Singapore was for chewing gum on the subway. So that seemed a bit much, because we all chew gum on the subway, don't we? But the caning part of it, that never bothered me. That seems to me ever so much more humane than sticking people in prison. Where, by the way, now it's just become a late night staple about how people get raped in prison. Isn't that funny? So the idea that caning, which I think could be very satisfying to the victims, you know, if I was arrested for selling pot or something, I'd much rather be caned than give up 5 years of my life. So that's my comment. Let's hear what Thane has to say.
Well, the point you made a moment ago is the correct one as well, which is that when you said it was for chewing gum, that goes back to the point I made before, proportionate. We've throughout our natural history of our species, we understand, you said it, this doesn't make sense for chewing gum, for being caned. When it's proportionate and just, it's something that feels fundamentally fair. Let me give you another anecdote from the book, unfortunately one of my favorite ones, but one of the most morally complex. This comes out of Iran, where a female student from the University of Tehran who had rejected the advances of a male suitor, he was so disappointed or so upset with her for not going out on a date, he threw acid in her face and disfigured her and blinded her. And when, and in Iran, by the way, victims are given a seat at the table. They're not shunted to the back of the courtroom. When the punishment was being defined, the judge said what they normally say in Iran is, what do you think we should do? And she said, I think he should have acid put in his eye. That's really two eyes for an eye. And the judge had seriously, you know, they immediately sought to implement it and have it done in a hospital by a doctor.
Wow.
Now, people look at this and they go, wow.
That that's what I just did.
They go, that is barbaric. What kind of a country does that? And then I say, all right, do you have any daughters?
Okay.
You have a daughter that's in college, and say, yes, the guy she didn't want to date him. He threw acid in her face. She's now blinded and disfigured for life. And you think what? He should be subject to some kind of plea bargain for 5 years of prison?
Thane, I've got a caller here who has a good question. William in Belvedere. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, William.
Yes, thank you very much. And sometimes I recognize people use words without thinking about them too carefully, like the guest referring to that other caller is being lovely. At any rate, I would appreciate the guest's perspective. He said that we are hardwired for revenge. Now, I take hardwired to mean it's into our genes or something. Now, in light of that perspective, I would appreciate his perspective on why different countries have such different kinds of standards of punishment. I'm sure you're aware, for instance, that fella in Norway who killed all those people, he's in prison, but he's getting to go to college as well. I just use that as an example.
Yeah, and we just heard the example of Iran, I think it was. Oh, thanks for the question, William. Why is there such variation, Thane, around the world if we're so hardwired for revenge?
I still think our first caller was lovely. I really do. There was nothing about her that didn't seem lovely. Look, Norway's a problematic example. The country went through an incredible amount of internal moral ambivalence about the fact that the highest sentence you can get, I think, for murder in Norway is 17 years.
Wow.
And I think he killed 66 kids. This is not something that they feel great about. In fact, the odds are that he never will be released because there are some statutory provisions that will keep him in prison anyway, because they recognize that isn't in no way can possibly be commensurate with his crime. It doesn't settle the score. It doesn't even the debt. This is not a nation that's so proud of the fact that this guy's only been given 17 years.
Fine.
And by the way, in that courtroom, every single one of the families was given an attorney. All of the children's autopsy reports were introduced into evidence. Each of the parents got to stand before the nation and the courtroom to tell the world and the nation and their nation who their kid was, who was lost. We wouldn't do anything like this here. Why? Too prejudicial.
Thane, so I think in answer to that, caller, you would say, actually, if you look around the world at people's degree of satisfaction or dissatisfaction when vengeance isn't an element of the justice system, you would see that where it isn't, there is dissatisfaction, and where it is, there's
absolutely
more satisfaction. So that shows the universality of it.
Yes, and in fact, let me just go back to something one of you said earlier in connection with South Africa. One of you said, well, you see, they work off the model of forgiveness. First of all, that's not true. Reconciliation is not quite the same thing as forgiveness. Even Archbishop Tutu said, well, you know, he was disappointed as an Anglican priest that there wasn't forgiveness in South Africa. But if you go to South Africa today and ask most people on the street, what do they think of the TRC? They said, it's necessary that we did it, but we all walk around wondering, how is it possible that these people got away without ever being punished?
So on that question, which we're not going to answer, I'm going to thank you for joining us, Thane. It's been a great conversation, really has.
Same here, gentlemen. I'm very grateful to be asked. Thank you.
Our guest has been Thane Rosenbaum. He's a professor of law at Fordham University. He's author of Payback, The Case for Revenge. So, John, you want to take some revenge on anybody today?
No. I'm attracted by some parts of Thane's view, but I think that, to me, the obverse is more worrisome. That is that the state punishes in ways that go far beyond what any victim would reasonably demand for the crime that's been committed.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I just think that revenge might be part of it, but it can't be the whole of it, because punishment plays such a complex social role, and it's not just about the victims. It's about many different things. But this conversation will continue. Continue on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also follow our tweets on Twitter, and you can find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page.
Now we're going to hear from the man who takes his revenge in the form of fast talking. That's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, according to the Oakland Tribune, Oakland, California is now the robbery capital of America with 12 robberies per day. What's to blame? Racism, poverty, poor governance, corruption, budget woes, education cutbacks, no role models, gang activity, and the conspicuous use of cell phones. If we didn't use them in public, criminals wouldn't know we had them, wouldn't steal them. It's our own fault. Just goes to show, even if your aim for justice is a simple eye for an eye, well, what is an eye? What's even a crime? You could call the 2013 government shutdown a crime, but who's to blame? Republicans were wanting an end to Obamacare, Democrats were not ending it. Just after the shutdown, veterans showed up at a World War II monument, which was not open. Suddenly, some conservative congresspeople showed up, rolled the barriers away, and ushered the vets in. It was captured on video. Can you believe it? A Republican from Texas then yelled at a park ranger for not having the monument open. In Tea Party world, barriers around monuments immediately became known as barricades, after Barry Obama. Get it? But on Fox News, the shutdown itself became known as the slim down. Well, which was it? Was it a conspiracy by Obama and his jackbooted minions to keep 90-year-old men from seeing the sights? Or was it a surprisingly workable diet plan? What's the crime, in other words? Whose eye do we gouge out? Back here in Oakland, robberies aside, street protests are as common as hurricanes in Oklahoma. The Trayvon Martin verdict in Florida sent hundreds of people into the street, though I didn't quite follow the logic. I'll throw a rock through the window of a Taco Bell in Northern California. That will show the flawed Florida legal system. Some of the news drew me up even shorter, however. Some windows were broken at Youth Radio, an Oakland-based nonprofit entity that trains young people in media production. Asked for a comment, a young person who teaches journalism at Youth Radio said, "It makes me really sad. I believe that it's probably young people who did this, and they just don't know what this space is for." So the message I'm getting from the left is that the rioters are only supposed to break those Oakland windows that send a clear message about racism. Along with the legal system, the rioting system obviously has some serious flaws. Maybe we should print up a map of businesses marked with a red for nice business, do not throw rock through window of, and a blue for bad business, burn if you can. There could be an app for that, something you could overlay on top of Google Maps. You'll stand with your Molotov cocktail in one hand, your smartphone in the other, pointing at buildings. If it's okay to trash, crosshairs will appear. It's that simple. In a perfect world, of course, every time some miscarriage of justice occurred in the world, lefties and righties would both know which eye to pluck, intuitively. But we've lost that skill. Now righties need gerrymandered voting districts before they can even dream of voting their blinkered conscience. And lefty protesters have to wear a duplicate of the Guy Fawkes mask worn by Hugo Weaving in the Warner Brothers movie V for Vendetta. That is, the copyrighted, universally recognized corporate symbol for anarchy. It's a convenience, but I miss the days when we could all spot lefties using only our minds. Today, only the Tea Party has that ability. It only works on Barack Obama. Turns out that may be cutting off your nose to spite your face, but at least the room isn't filling up with eyes. So far, I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and of the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2013.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Our director of marketing is Dave Millar. Gorilla Kreitmar is our performance consultant.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Jimmy Tobin, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Hello! My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Stop saying that!